just runs in a circle.
Hello and welcome to Campfires and Color Wars, a podcast about summer camps and the stories we love to tell about them. Like the time Lee Baim told her cabin she was out running the lake, but she was really returning from her boyfriend Danny's cabin, and they totally bought it. Well done. I'm Micah Hart, and for the next 45 minutes or so, we're going to press pause on the world around us and transport back to the days of our adolescence, when the school year was just one long rest hour between days at camp. If you have a camp memory you'd like to have featured at the top of the show, you can email us your short stories at summercamppod@gmail.com. And if you're going to do that, why not go on iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review, so we can continue to reach as many former campers as we can. Want to welcome, again, new listeners who are discovering the podcast thanks to the success of our game show, Jewish Geography Zoom Racing. If you have not had a chance to check it out yet, I highly recommend it. Every Saturday night at 9 o'clock, streaming live on our Facebook page. And we've also since added a Wednesday night show, also at 9 o'clock, also streaming live, that is a little bit of a different format. But it's been a lot of fun and continues to grow. And the community that is springing up around the show, I just have to say, has really been awesome to watch. The purpose of the game is really just to connect people and kind of have a good time while we're all sitting around looking for something to do in quarantine. But one thing that has really, been such a wonderful surprise about the show is how so many people are reconnecting, not just the contestants, but the people in the comments. I think if you ask people which do they enjoy more, the show they're watching or the conversations they're having with their friends while watching it, maybe 50-50, maybe 60-40 in favor of the comments. But it's just really been a great way for lots of people to reconnect with people from all different parts of their lives, myself included. I've gotten to catch up to so many people and make so many new friends as well through it. So again, if you haven't seen it, I can't recommend it strongly enough. It's really fun, and I've said this before, you don't even have to be Jewish to enjoy it. I definitely have friends who are not Jewish, who are regular viewers. Shout out to all of them. Shout out to all the viewers. But yeah, this is a really fun episode tonight. I was supposed to release this last week, and in the midst of editing, I was just to the end. All I had left to do was this part that I'm saying right now. And my program crashed, and I lost it all. And I just sat there staring at my computer screen, and nothing happened. I thought maybe if I stared long enough, it would come back, but it did not. So we're a week late. There you have it. But I think it was worth the wait, because this is a really fun episode with Jeffrey Yoskowitz and Liz Alpern of Gefilteria. They were the organizers of the Great Big Jewish Food Fest that took place back in May, and this was recorded right after that. Just a really awesome thing they put together. Go check it out online, and check out Gefilteria, because they're doing some really interesting stuff with Ashkenazi recipes from the olden days and modernizing them and making them delicious. They say they make delicious gefilte fish. I'm going to have to see it to believe it, but I believe after talking to them, they probably are doing it well. So this is a really fun conversation, and so let's get on with it. Our conversation with Jeffrey Yoskowitz and Liz Alpern. So I came across the Great Big Jewish Food Fest not that long ago, and it just seemed like a really cool idea. And anytime people are doing something that seems really cool, my first thought is, I wonder if they went to camp. And then usually I'll reach out and find out if that's true or not. So when I saw that this was going on, I reached out to you guys, and I'm happy to say that you did go to camp, and you're interested in at least talking to me about it for a little bit. So welcome.
Thanks, Micah.
Thanks,
Glad
Micah.
To be here.
Thanks.
Yeah, so I guess we'll get to your camp background in just a minute, but if we could talk just for a sec about the food festival, how did it go?
It was amazing. I mean, it was a very ambitious 10-day festival. I mean, I'd say over 50 events. We had about 20,000 people who were part of it. And we raised $150,000. But like, but most importantly, it was really, we had a great time. We had some really great sessions. We had people cooking together, people making cocktails and drinking together. We had just like some really interesting stuff that we were able to do using this new digital medium that we're in, you know, these Zoom calls and things like that. And it was really awesome. I mean, Liz, you can probably speak to more details. That was my macro assessment.
Yeah, no, I love the macro. And I'd say, you know, when we, Jeffrey and I have a company called The Gefilteria. And when we first started The Gefilteria, we thought that we were the only people who were really, you know, excited and passionate about gefilte fish. But it turned out lots of people were excited about it. And I think when we imagined this great big Jewish food festival, we knew that there would be some people excited about it, but we never could have imagined that there'd be this many people excited about it. So it was like a parallel experience in that when if you build it, they will come. It was such a wide range of events, and that also helped get out so many different people with so many different types of interests. Even my mom told me that she heard Michael Twitty speak, and she said to me today, you know, I don't really care about cooking very much, but he was just amazing talking about culture. And I said, there's something for everyone at the Great Big Jewish Food Festival.
Were you planning to do this already and then you had to pivot to make it digital because of the pandemic? Or was this an idea that sprung from everybody's sitting around trying to figure out what to do, and this would be a great way to bring people together in these trying times?
The latter. This very much was an initiative that came about, well, for a number of reasons, one of which was, you know, we work in the food world, and, you know, I mean, I'd say events of ours through December of, you know, 2020 were canceled. And that's what we do. And a lot of our friends in the restaurant industry, the restaurants were closed. There was amazing talent that was just available and ready and willing. And at the same time, we were, you know, so Liz and I, with our company Gefilteria, we were doing a lot of digital workshops, teaching people how to cook and stuff around Passover time. And we were noticing that there were some opportunities in the, you know, in being able to stream into people's homes, being able to cook alongside them, being able to answer questions and look to see what people are doing, if they're doing it right or not. And it was kind of an opportunity, we thought, well, people are also more interested in cooking at home than now than ever.
Absolutely.
People are looking for some kind of connection and community. And there's amazing people in the food world who's, you know, we wanted to provide a platform for all of them, and we wanted to engage folks who may not have had work or had to close their restaurants over the last couple of months, and all those factors together. And we did it all to raise money for COVID-19 relief efforts. So it was very much born out of this moment, for the moment. And I think that's one of the things we're most proud of. I mean, we really planned and produced this entire event 6 weeks start to finish.
That's so incredible. And I mean, honestly, good on both of you. This is where I think camp comes in, and where I'm curious to hear your stories, because one of the hallmarks to me of the camp experience, and I'll speak for myself, but I think this is fairly true for a lot of people, is you have to figure out ways to adapt. I mean, you have to adapt to everything. You have to adapt to sharing space with, you know, 10 other people. You have to adapt to eating different foods if it's not what you're seeing at home. And if you're a staff member and you're planning events for the day, if it rains, you have to adapt. If the program isn't going well, if you can't get the supplies you need, there's so much adaptation and spontaneity and creativity that I learned from growing to camp. And so I'm curious if that played at all a role in your approach to building this, or gave you any of the tools to make it happen in the first place.
I will just say, you know, Micah, one of the things I was with my parents today, actually, for the first time since quarantine. And one of the conversations I had with my mom, because I told her I was going to be talking to you later today, is, you know, she was telling me I never wanted to come home from camp. Whenever I was going for a month, I would stay another 2 weeks. And I didn't even remember having those conversations with her, but she didn't even hesitate to tell me, oh, you never wanted to come home. And I said, I think that the thing that I loved about it was actually being on my own and getting to kind of solve problems on my own. And there's something about when you're away from home, where you get to, for the first time, and you get to improvise and you get to learn how to adapt and kind of see what you're made of in a way, right? And we all develop in different areas, but there's probably something in that, the initiative you needed to take that I was just really excited about as a kid. And so I'm, you know, this event was all about taking initiative and just sort of the spirit of entrepreneurship and creativity. And so I think that the early training that I think that you're hitting on is that when you're younger and you go away from home, you've got to figure it out, right? You've got to develop that skill set because you don't really have a choice, you know, and in a good way. I think that's in a good way. So that's something that I could think about.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I had a couple of summers in my lifetime working staff at a camp, and I'd say that was when I really had to adapt and had to be creative and had to make things happen. As a camper, I often felt like I was being shepherded. And like I often felt like I was I had less agency. And then when I took agency, I usually did it on my own, and I would sneak away into the woods, or I'd sneak out and do things. And I wasn't always adapting. I mean, I guess there's an entrepreneurial spirit. Now that we're talking, I'm remembering, I did like run a lot of businesses at camp, and would sell things, and like would like, you know, sneak things, you know, whether it was candy or
were you like Red from Shawshank?
Well, here's the deal, Mike. I went to two like camps in my lifetime. I went to Habonim Dror camp, which was a socialist Zionist camp.
Sure.
And
which one?
I went to Camp Galil. So I did that for 1 year of my life when I was 8. I was the youngest kid in camp. And I was there for this traumatic summer at camp when the entire camp somehow on a trip got stuck in an open field in a lightning storm.
Oh my God.
And we were all like being put under tarps while the bus came. And like one group at a time, they would bring us all onto a bus. And then we all had to sleep in some random building. And all I remember from that was like being cold and damp and then eating lemon poppy seed muffins. But after that year, I went to a New Jersey Y camp called Najiwa, and then had the older camp for Cedar Lake, and I went there for 6 years. And I always joke that I went from a socialist camp to a capitalist camp, and everyone there had a business. You know, so you, like, people would bring candy and have, like, padlocks, and they'd have all these things that they would sneak in and, you know, and then sell it to each other. And so I got in on that, and you would, you know, make as much money as possible. For the end of camp, we'd go to Dorney Park, the amusement park, where I could then go waste all the money trying to win a basketball. And so I do think maybe there's something about like adapting to that, the capitalist spirit of these New Jersey Y camps and you know, really running a business. I mean, in some ways, this event was very much, and a lot of the work that Liz and I do together is very much this entrepreneurial spirit. So as we're talking, Micah, I'm appreciating that I guess camp sort of helped cultivate that in me.
So when are you going? I guess when COVID's over, that's when you'll go to the amusement park.
Oh my God. I'll wait a little bit for things to settle down, but I love a good roller coaster. I haven't been to one in a while. I would love to go back to an amusement park.
Liz, where did you go to camp?
I went to camp at a JCC camp in Connecticut called Camp Laurelwood. It was low key. I hear stories of these kind of fancy camps and I never even knew they really existed. I mean, it was a nice enough camp, but, I just really remember roaming around a lot, you know? And I will say that, I have to say this because it's the most important thing about camp for me, which is that I discovered at camp my passion for the only sport that I play, which is tennis, nice. At camp. And I was the kid who became BFF with all the counselors. So I would get away with certain things and I would always play tennis at night when you were supposed to be like hanging out. I somehow got to play night tennis. And to this day, playing tennis at night is what under the lights. Oh my gosh. I mean, it's one of the greatest joys that I can imagine. It is so freeing and so much fun. And I always felt like I somehow worked the system and got to be on the cool night shift on the tennis court.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that in a couple ways. One, there is a skill in becoming friends with the counselors, but not in a way that like alienates your peers. And it does, you know, if you play your cards right, like, yeah, you do kind of, even if you don't get special favors, special treatment, it just helps grease the wheels, without question.
What I'd add to that is that I think camp was very much a system that could be worked. And I definitely worked the system also. And I mean, I would play basketball at night, Liz, and I love playing basketball in lights in the dark when it's cool enough. But I would get out of chores. It's also knowing when to not be in the cabin when they were going to go around and assign chores or make you have to sign up for things. And by conveniently being somewhere else and never having to sign up, then I had free rein during the day and I roamed too. And I remember by the time I was older and was done with, I've done all the activities. I've done rocketeering, which we had. I've done, you know, all the arts and crafts, which I loved. I've done everything. I would just like want to go and wander around the woods myself. And I was just like, I knew when to avoid the signups. And that was a lot of what camp was learning how to manipulate people and get what you want.
That's so funny.
It's totally true.
I don't play basketball at night on staff. And, you know, Liz, I completely agree with what you're saying. Like, when I think about playing basketball, like at midnight, that is like such a happy place for me. It was so fun. Mm-hmm. And we would play until, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm 41 years old right now. And if I could get a midnight basketball game going, I would happily participate. I'd be super, super sore the next day, but it would be worth it.
Micah, I'm there. I'm there.
Liz, I love it. You said, you know, you found your passion of tennis. Mine was tetherball.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, tetherball. Oh, my gosh.
I was so fucking good at tetherball. I have no problem bragging about it. I fundamentally believe to my bones that if tetherball had been an Olympic sport, I could have represented some country.
Micah, do you watch 30 Rock? Do you
remember
they had an episode where they had created fake Olympic games and tetherball was one of them. And there was this like Olympic tetherball athlete that NBC created to make money.
Oh my God. How did I, yes, I watched every episode of that show. How did I not, I mean, surely I saw it, but I can't believe it didn't stick with me. I'm going to go back and watch it.
Oh my gosh, you've got to go watch. I think it's season 3 or 4.
Okay.
They make up a whole fake Summer Olympics thing to have America win more things. And like the tetherball champion is the problem guy.
That's awesome. All I know is I would kick Napoleon Dynamite's ass. Let's just leave it at that. So one question I have for you guys about Gefilteria is, you know, when I think about camp, I think about tradition being such a big piece of it. And I feel like just from the little I've read about Gefilteria on your website, it seems like that's a lot of what you're trying to, you know, to bring current, sort of taking these traditional dishes and making them, you know, relevant to the present. How did you guys start down that path?
Oh, Micah, we would need a longer time, but I can tell you the deep and brief. I can tell you the deep and brief, which is that Jeffrey and I had both been working in the food world separately, doing our own thing, and we kept crisscrossing paths, and eventually we kind of discovered that we had a shared love, a shared passion for Ashkenazi Jewish food, right? This is the food that we grew up with. So kugel and matzo balls and gefilte fish. And we were really the only, we didn't know anybody else who was passionate about this cuisine. In fact, what we saw in our contemporaries in the food world was everybody's like, oh, that food is brown, it's boring, it's heavy, it's my grandma, you know. And in fact, a lot of people that we encountered from our generation saw these dishes as relics of the past, so only to be eaten for tradition's sake, not because they're good, right? So,
right.
Obviously, you know, we because of, you know, Jeffrey's grandmother is from Poland, and just because of our various pieces of exposure, we knew how good this cuisine was when done right, and so that's how we were able to cultivate a share, you know, a passion for this food, and so when we discovered that we both were so devastated by the way that the food world was looking at our Ashkenazi traditional food, we decided to do something about it. We decided to join forces, and we started with gefilte fish because that was really the place to start. But from there, you know, it's, you know, 9 years later and we're still doing it, still making old recipes new again. And, so, and discovering a lot of recipes along the way, a lot of culinary wisdom. So it's really, really been exciting and surprising to us how multi-layered this journey's been, I guess.
I'm gonna assume, based on the fact that you guys have been doing this for 9 years, that you're good at what you do and you know how to do it well. And so I'm gonna preface that by saying, how do you make gefilte fish good?
Yeah. One of the things I'll say, by the way, is that we started with gefilte fish, but now it's we manufacture and produce gefilte fish that we sell around the holidays. But now it's only one small part of what we do. To answer your question about the gefilte fish, we actually make it using good ingredients. We don't have it in a jar looking like some like disgusting blobs in suspended in gel that have been sitting in the kosher aisle of the supermarket for years in packaging that has been changed since the 1960s. No, we use fresh ingredients, sustainably sourced ingredients. Where we have ours. It comes in a beautiful tureen. It's multicolored. It's tastes fresh and
no fillers, no junk in there. Nothing like, you know, muscle meal or potato starch or any of that stuff.
Yeah. So it's yeah, exactly. So and at the end of the day, what gefilte fish is just it's really nice fish that's ground and baked in a tureen or in a canal. And so that's what we do. And you know, we sell our gefilte fish in some gourmet shops. We sell it, you know, in some of the nicest places around the tri-state area. We ship it around the country. And every year we make as much as we can and we sell out because there's a demand for really high quality gefilte fish. That said, we also do, you know, we wrote a cookbook a few years ago. We do a lot of events. We do a lot of teaching people how to cook a lot of these foods. So gefilte fish is just around the holidays, and otherwise we're really exploring and telling the story of what Ashkenazi food is. So the foods of Jews of Eastern European and Central European origin. And I think that is, again, it's using good ingredients. It's really being more expansive in how we think about these foods. Like it's not just kugels and latkes and brown foods. It's actually, it's a seasonal cuisine that's rooted to a land and kind of connecting people to that story and also to the emotions that are at the heart of what the cuisine is and what the culture is.
That's so cool. And the way you describe it, it does actually make it sound appetizing. The way that I'm used to seeing it is exactly the way you described it. So
no, and I just say a lot of what happened to Jewish food or Ashkenazi Jewish food in particular is it got very industrialized. So people think that latkes come in a box, powdered. That matzo balls come in a box, and you know, people don't really think that matzo balls come from matzah at the end of Passover, or, you know, like, you know, that you actually do grate potatoes by hand. It's this beautiful, you know, a beautiful potato pancake that you would make that would be very different than the powdered version. And so I think a lot of that misunderstanding comes from, I mean, and camp does not help this at all, right? Because, right, you know, let's just say camp foods weren't always the best, and often things came in powdered forms, and the Jewish versions of foods, if they were ever served, were not very good. I'm thinking of Shabbat, I'm thinking of the dried chicken, and you know, soggy potatoes, and whatever else I'm trying, I can't even remember what else was served on Shabbat at camp, but that was definitely my experience. And I think that what we're part of a movement of people that are reclaiming these traditions, that are also kind of rejecting some of that mid-century industrialization that led to the bastardization of these foods.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in the questionnaire a little bit, but I am curious for your take on the camp food that you ate growing up.
Well, you know, the thing I most remember about camp food, because I had a feeling we would get to this question. The thing I most remember is that, you know, Monday was mac and cheese, and then Tuesdays were whatever, pizza, and then Wednesdays were, you know, and then there was milk days and meat days because it was kosher kitchens. But I really remember the flow. I don't remember exactly what was served on each of those days, but I remember that each day had its identity. And one of the pieces of camp that was exciting was looking forward to the day that you loved, you know? And I certainly, of course, like all kids, loved pizza. But I remember loving also that there was always a salad bar, for example. I thought that was very exciting as a kid that you could go and make something all on your own. So I really loved knowing the day that was coming. And I think there was something about that routine, that just made each day exciting. And I also, we had waiters at our camp, which I know not all camps do, but I remember very distinctly having waiters.
Excuse me, Liz, wow.
Fancy camp,
very,
I know.
Very different than my socialist Zionist camp, where we had young corporate domination, and we all the people who were chosen to be lower class had to serve the people that were higher class.
I've heard about those socialist Zionist camps, and it's... Sounds pretty wild. I was very thrilled to have, you know, cool teenage boys, and who were probably like 13, you know, be our waiters. And you'd always be very proud of whoever your waiter was. You're like, that's my man. He is the coolest waiter of all. So I just remember the experience of the day and the waiters. So I really can picture, I can picture sitting at the table. I can picture the waiters. I can like picture the parade of the waiters right now. You know?
It's so funny that you say that. So this is a brief aside, but I promise it's relevant or related at least, maybe not relevant. We've been trying to get outside as much as we can during the pandemic.
Yeah.
We've taken to, you know, hiking a lot. And so we live in Atlanta. We've actually gotten outside of the city way more in the past few months than we have probably the entirety of my kids' lives. And so, you know, Sometimes there's an hour plus drive. And so we'll put on playlists of songs that everybody in the family gets to help choose. And my kids, I feel like I'm doing my dad duty here. I'm trying to introduce them to like funny music. And so they're on a real Weird Al Yankovic kick right now, which that's a
tangent. Oh, yeah.
But they're like, put something funny on. And I put on Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, the summer camp song from like the 50s.
Yeah, of course.
And there's a line in the song that says, all the counselors hate the waiters. And I heard that sort of like all my life, but never really thought about it until I listened to it recently. I'm like, waiters? What waiters? So it's really, when you say that, I'm like, okay.
We have the waiters.
Camp. Maybe he went to your camp.
Yeah, there was, and I'm telling you, this was not a fancy
camp.
Yeah, that Alan Sherman.
Jeffrey, I feel like that was maybe a business that you could have found some, you know, found some way into of doing some, you know, some light waitering on the side.
Maybe. I mean, I'll be honest. I had a lot of businesses going on. I was folding people's laundry after laundry day, and I used to fold. And that was great. I'm a great folder to this day. And I made big money cleaning up and arranging people's cubbies before visiting day. That was big money. I learned how to massage. A friend of mine his father was a chiropractor, and he taught me how to massage people's like third eye to like put them to sleep. And so like I offered for people who couldn't fall asleep that I would come and like massage their third eye. Like, you know, between their eyes and, you know, right like above their nose and charge them like a dollar to do that. And I would go, you know, people would be like, hey, I can't sleep. I'd go over there and I'd make some money when people had trouble sleeping.
Yeah. So, what kind of money are we talking here? How much are you getting for the laundry folding?
I mean, like, listen, we're talking like $2-3 max. The big money was if you had, if you were able to somehow get sodas smuggled in and a cooler and ice. And then you had your ice cooler, and you had birch beer and root beer and other things that you could then sell people at night, cool sodas. Like that was the big money. I never had, I couldn't get there. So
is this a day camp? Is this like an overnight camp? You're there for like 4 weeks?
Mike, I'm telling you, people had hookups. So if you were friends with the counselors would get you, you know, you had your phone coolers hidden in your what's it called, your trunk that was padlocked, and then you would fill it with ice. You'd steal ice from the ice machines in the main building. You would, you would get your counselors, this who all went out every night to get you some sodas. So like, there was one or two kids who had the hookup, and they made some big money from that.
That is incredible.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was ultra hyper capitalist camp
for sure.
But I will say about the food though, one of the things I remember and to this day really appreciate about camp food and experiences, like conferences and things, it's like I love not having to think about meals. And even as a kid, you know, like I was in a family, both my parents worked, like I had to, you know, put meals together. You know, dinner was often made, but you know, if I was home, I'd have to think about lunch or breakfast. I love just, there's a cereal bar. There's, you know, fine, bad pancakes, baked scrambled eggs, whatever. It's there. I don't have to think about it. And there was a regularity, like Liz said, a schedule, grilled cheese and tomato soup on one day, spaghetti and meatballs. And, you know, yeah, I'm not a food snob. Like, I prefer to eat better versions of things, but like, it's really nice to just have that regularity, to have something that you can expect, and it just frees you in some ways. And so, you know, when you start to like it, like you start to like the bug juice, you start to like these things, and it just takes time, and you start to love, like realize that the best way to eat these sort of dry grilled cheeses is to dip them into the tomato soup. And then you have this soggier grilled cheese that you're then eating that's very tomato-y, and that's the only way you can do it that works. And you find those strategies. I always went to camp for, you know, 7-8 weeks. And so by the end, like I knew how to make everything work for me. And that was sort of what I left with. Like I left with all this knowledge that then got lost, and then I had to relearn it the next year. But I miss that about camp. And in general, like, to be honest, even when I was a staff member at camps, like I really enjoyed and appreciated not having to, you know, ever worry about, you know, being hungry, because I knew that I would find something.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And it's funny, I'm sad in a way that neither one of you, I can't bring you back in time to Jacob's Camp in Mississippi where I grew up, because my dad was a camp director. And I guess, I don't know if it was something he believed strongly in or just the way it developed over time, but we had like a fully staffed kitchen who made everything from scratch. So we had real food, like good food. I mean, not all of it was amazing, but like we had fried chicken that I would argue to this day is still the best fried chicken that I've ever had.
Nice. Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, we had like some really like great soul food, you know, cuisine that they all made. And I mean, it's funny because I went to another camp, and at that camp, I would end up just eating, you know, peanut butter sandwiches most of the time. And then I'd come home to Jacob's and just stuff my face most of the time. I mean, the banana pudding was incredible. All of the like black eyed peas and lima beans and all the stuff that was just delicious.
Oh man. I mean, it sounds like you also had like Southern comfort food.
Yeah,
that was
totally
a part of the experience, which is, it actually lends itself really well to the cafeteria style.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it was really good. I miss it. But nevertheless, well, let's move on to our Campfires and Color Wars questionnaire, title still pending. Number one, tell us about your most romantic camp moment.
I'll be the first to admit that I did have, you know, maybe my first kiss at camp, but I would really not call that romantic. So
it's so funny.
Interpret right. as you will.
Well, so here's the thing. So on a very recent episode, someone was saying that they also had their first kiss at camp and that they really enjoyed it. And I was stunned.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah, no,
most
I'd say,
I know,
I'd say that, that got a thumbs down, you know, that got a thumbs down from small Liz. I was like, I don't know about this.
All right. So what was the, give me a little, you know, whatever you feel comfortable sharing, like give me some
set
of the
scene,
yeah,
Liz.
Set the scene for us.
Oh, well, you know, I remember, I think I had like my first like three kisses at camp, but you know, I remember that there's this one boy that I suppose he became my boyfriend, and through what complex negotiation that occurred. I can't even imagine. But I remember it was like a pre-Shabbat or something. And everyone's like, oh, are you guys going to kiss? Are you going to kiss? You know, there's all the crowds around. And somehow we like walked over together and had like a little peck on the lips, very sheepishly, clearly under the pressure of the, you know, the other campers. And I just remember feeling like, wow, well, that feels, you know, like I don't feel like I've accomplished anything. Like that was just, that was kind of, you know, I don't think I even had any hopes for it. I just said, I don't think that that was the transformative experience it's supposed to be that they tell you about in the movies. This little peck in the midst of a crowd pre-Shabbat or something, you know? I actually ran into that guy years later at a music festival, and I was like, wow, interesting.
That's so funny.
Were you his first kiss?
I don't know, actually. I really don't know. I would imagine so. I would imagine that that's true. And that was probably why there was some pressure on.
Yeah, when you get the friends involved, it starts to build. You want it to be away from the crowd if you can help it. Jeffrey, what about you?
Yeah, the crowd was not good. Yeah.
Camp was not a place of romance for me. You know, I remember I had a, you know, I think I started at my capitalist camp in like fourth or fifth grade. But I had girlfriends back at home from school, and camp was just like, for me, I remember like not knowing how to navigate that, and like I was always in the boy bunk area, and then, you know, like I didn't even know, we didn't always have like the time and space to like get to know people. And so I get to know girls from the girl bunk, and you know, and so for me, camp was like playing, it was basketball, it was all those things, and like the romance, not that there was like that much romance, was for me in school. And I remember not even knowing like how to make that happen at camp, you know. And like it was just like a few people who did, and otherwise it was just like a bunch of like young boys in my cabin running around and like having fun and like not thinking about it, until we got toward the later stages of camp, where that became like all camp was people were thinking about. And I felt like it was too late. Like I didn't even know how to translate camp culture, my experience there, into some kind of romance. So I don't think I had a single romantic episode at camp.
I have to say, Jeffrey, I've done about 70 plus episodes of the show, and I think you're the first person I've ever heard talk about how they had girlfriends at home, but not at camp, because for most of it was definitely the opposite.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, Micah. My in fourth and fifth grade in my elementary school, like this was like actually something that was really hard for me. I remember I was like the oldest kid in school, which meant a lot, you know. In fifth grade, I was like the fastest kid in school, and I was like fifth grade, but I was really popular in my elementary school, and I was not popular in camp. And like it was like really, you know, like all these people like had these like, you know, they came into themselves in camp, and that was where they found themselves. For me, it was like, it was a buzzkill. Like I was like, I lost my, you know, I lost whatever, you know, importance I had. I lost whatever cachet I had in camp. And that was hard. And so,
you know what,
school,
Jeffrey? I was the same. I had the same experience.
Wow.
Yep. So that is something we share. I was like, medium average, the most average person at camp. And in school, I was like a cool kid. You know, I had a lot of friends. At camp, I had like three friends. I'm still friends with them. So
totally.
I really hear you. That resonates.
Totally. And it's like funny to like think about it in that way, and like this like spectrum of cool and all that. But it's totally the case. And like sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, like, you know, schools merged. I was no longer like the coolest kid in school at all. But I was still cooler in school than I was in camp.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
But
I know that's
that
not a typical thing, Micah. Yeah.
A lot of the reason, though, is a lot of kids in like, especially the capitalist camp, you know, where I went for most of my time, a lot of kids all knew each other from school. I was one of only a couple of kids from my school. So, you know, there was a lot of kids all from Long Island. I'm from New Jersey. A lot of kids from Brooklyn. And so they all came with their own cliques and their own groups. And I remember never knowing how to fully navigate those groups.
Okay, that actually makes more sense to me now. And Liz, you were also in the Northeast, right?
Yeah, and actually that resonates with me as well, Jeffrey, is that my camp was mostly folks from Connecticut, and I was not. I was from Long Island. So that may have also played a role in my relationship to the like cool kids clubs that were going on. I also was not, for me, I knew this, that I was not one of those kids who had been going to camp since I was 8. And then there was like the old guard, you know, and I was not part of the old guard. And legacy has something, to do with your status at camp, for sure. Like, I got along well enough. Remember, I had great friends and the counselors who let me play night tennis, but I wasn't necessarily the long-standing camp forever cool kid. I was like, oh, I'm a nice girl from Long Island crashing this party, but we're happy to have you here, Liz.
I did spend 1 week, Micah, at a basketball camp, at the 76ers basketball camp when I was nice. In middle school. And it was really interesting because it was not, I was there with a friend of mine. We were two of, four Jewish kids at the camp. It was not a Jewish camp. And we, and most people didn't really know each other. So it was kind of this like opportunity to kind of completely start over and be in this like fresh environment. And it was just a week. And it felt freeing in a way that being at camp where everyone knew each other from the past didn't feel. Yeah. And so I remember appreciating that and getting to reinvent myself was kind of cool.
Nice. All right. Well, wow. We did well on question one. Question two, tell us about your best camp performance.
I was not someone who ever performed in a talent show and still do not. However,
don't do talent shows. Okay.
Still don't do talent shows. I will say though that when I was like my first couple of years in camp, when we were all really young, elementary school, we used to, after shower time, just like all run around naked in the bunks. And it was just like, we had this like naked time and we all just like ran around. And I remember once jumping up onto the bunk bed and like belting out Fiddler on the Roof. And that I think was perhaps my best camp performance.
That's a memorable performance. The whole thing, soup to nuts or?
No, I don't remember. Maybe it was tradition. I don't remember. Maybe I was just screaming, Fiddler on the Roof. I honestly don't recall, but I just remember like being in that position up there. And like, I remember like escalating this, like running around, young boys running around moment.
Sure.
And somehow I brought Fiddler on the Roof.
Nice. I was Fiddler in Fiddler on the Roof. Shout out to Fiddler, but I was clothed. Liz, what about you?
I'm gonna have to pass on this one. I too have never performed in a talent show and tend to avoid talent show like environments. But I got nothing. I'm sure I did something, but I really got nothing.
Fair enough. All right, well, number three, tell us about your most embarrassing camp moment.
I'll just say that I will say something a little bit soulful here, which is that, so this is not the exact story you're looking for, but I, at the end of each summer, at the end of each session, there was like an Olympics, obviously all these camps have an Olympics, and they would choose the captains of the Olympics teams, and it was a surprise. You didn't know which kids were going to be a captain. And I remember getting chosen as a captain of a team and remember that I was like a very average Joe camper, not particularly popular, but they saw potential in me. And I remember feeling very concerned because I got chosen and the like somewhat more popular kids had not gotten chosen. They did get chosen the next session, so I will give them that. But I remember being shocked, and I wouldn't say so much that I wasn't worried that I wouldn't be supported by the popular girls, by getting chosen. But I really remember having a moment of self-awareness as a kid, right? And thinking to myself, that wasn't supposed to happen. And I'm happy and proud, but I'm confused about why I feel conflicted about what this is about my status in this camp and what does it mean? And I don't know. And I just really remember that there was a little embarrassment because I didn't feel like I was supposed to get that job, And it's such a subtle thing, but I honestly remember having a real gut reaction when my name got announced and in the ensuing, few hours of celebration that that occurred. So that's a little bit deeper, but I can really, I can remember that feeling.
I love it. I mean, I don't love that, that you had that conflicted moment, but I love going deep.
Yeah.
All right, Jeffrey, can you follow that?
You know, I have this memory, you know, when I was at the socialist Zionist camp, my visiting day came, my parents brought, you know, a number of treats, you know, for me. One of my favorite things were those like little plastic containers of applesauce. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Those little guys. And I would like fold over the aluminum foil and like create a little like sipping area. And I would like squeeze and sip the applesauce. It's one of my favorite snacks. And my parents brought me a few other snacks as well. And they at the socialist camp really gave us like a really big speech about not, you know, having any food and how it's not good for, you know, there's animals and stuff, but also how it's not fair for other people who don't have the food. And they really kind of leaned on the socialist part of the camp environment and culture around that. And I remember I had hidden in these little hiding places, I had, you know, all these foods that I just got. And I couldn't sleep that night. I was so feeling so guilty. I did something wrong. And I just, I remember like, I don't know how, it feels like it was 2 or 3 in the morning. And I woke up and I went and got all of my candy and applesauce and other snacks. And I went and I think his name was Roberto, my counselor. He was a counselor from Mexico City, and I shook him, and I woke him up, and I gave him all of my candy and snacks, and then he sort of gave me a look, and he was just like it was like, you idiot, like you, we don't like, it was like, we don't care about this, like, you know, we just have to give this speech. Like he like looked at me and made me feel like I was so stupid for buying this that I, you know, everyone of course breaks the rules. Like everyone has candy and food, but I just remember feeling, I look back at myself. I'm like, what an idiot. Like, why didn't I just hold on to that applesauce, which I loved so much. And he just got to eat it himself. And I was just about to say, yeah, I just remember, I don't think it's not a typical embarrassing moment. Like I wasn't like in the spotlight, everything. I just like remember feeling like ashamed of myself.
No, it's like embarrassing now. Maybe not then.
It's embarrassing now. Exactly. Exactly. And I just remember like the waking him up, and like, it was a feeling of waking your parents up when you're scared, you know, it was like that kind of that vulnerability that you have in those moments. And I still wish I had that applesauce.
I'm glad you recognized that. I was going to say, yeah, he ate that shit.
Oh, completely, completely. Yeah. Yeah. I very much regret it. And that's, I think, why I became a hyper-capitalist at the capitalist camp. And like, I actually remember going, I loved arts and crafts, and I remember building a special box that had like a hidden layer underneath that from the back that you could pull out so I could hide all sorts of things. Like, I remember like being really obsessed with hiding places. And I got into that, I think, because of that shame and humiliation that came from that moment.
That's too funny. All right, number 4, top or bottom bunk?
Top bunk all the way. I love a top bunk. I still love a top bunk. I recently went to a hot springs, and my friend and I had bunk beds in our room, and I was super excited about the top bunk. Love looking down on the world. Love feeling like I have a secret hideaway. Always top.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been on the bottom bunk. I not only do I not trust the bottom bunk, it also just felt like, why would you... Like, it's like, you know, when you go on a bridge and you have the option of the bottom or like the top, you know, you always go to the top. You always want the upper bridge because you can see everything. And the bottom, you're just like, all you're looking at are the cars ahead of you. You know, so I felt the same way about the top bunk.
Plus, you gotta protect your merchandise if you have it, or, you know, or your stash of, you know, your money you've been earning. I mean, you know, bottom bunk, it's too close to prying hands.
Well, I also would bang nails into the rafters of the bunk, and I would have hats and all these things. I had all this storage space that I didn't have access to with the bottom bunk.
That's true. I think your bunkmate probably would have had some words for you. Yeah. All right, number 5. We touched about this a little bit, but I'll ask it nevertheless. What was your favorite camp food?
Grilled cheese and tomato soup, for sure. That combo, perfect. Nothing better.
You know, I loved the grilled cheese tomato soup day, but to this day, my comfort food is just, you know, spaghetti and tomato sauce. So I, and then like some really greasy garlic bread. So I gotta go with that because I still want to eat that all the time.
I think maybe you guys could do a new food festival that's elevating camp food. I think that was actually an episode of Top Chef this season.
Well, it's actually fun. It's fun to think about it because it's about cooking in bulk, right? And serving large masses of people, which is actually really relevant right now in these times.
A lot of
people doing a lot of community kitchens, community cooking.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, it was definitely the fried chicken. No question about it.
Well, I think if we had that fried chicken, it would be the fried chicken, too.
Agreed.
Yeah. Oh, it was so good. All right, well, let's move on to our last segment, Bitches and Roses, a.k.a. Roses and Thorns, a.k.a. Coals and Diamonds, a.k.a. Strawberries and Lemons, a.k.a. Peaks and Valleys, a.k.a. Pals and Wows. This is a chance just to share one good thing and one bad thing that's going on in your life. It can be macro or micro, however you choose. But I will let you guys go first. Liz, what's going on in your world?
Well, you know, Micah, it's not a very good time in the world in general. When people are going to be listening to this, but you know, we are living in a pandemic, and a global pandemic, might I add, and we are also facing a situation in which Black people in this country have been systematically facing really, really unacceptable abuse by those who are in power. And we're in a revolutionary moment, and it's really exciting, but it's really dark and it's scary, actually. And I live in New York City, and I'm hearing helicopters over my head right now. So it's not a great feeling. And I think that there's not much more we can say other than that at this point. But on a positive side, I just went and saw my parents for the first time since the pandemic started, and saw a friend. And got to walk on the beach today, right, and put my feet in the ocean and the sand. I've still got a bunch of sand between my toes right now. And I will say that that is extraordinarily grounding, extraordinarily strength-giving, and really, really good to reconnect with, you know, our senses when we're all up in our head and in our emotions.
It's such
a great point. So feeling grateful for that.
Yeah, it's such a great point. You know, it's interesting. As I'm hearing you talk, I'm thinking to myself that I might need to tweak this segment of the show for the time being, because
I was like, really, it's pretty heavy, man.
It's so hard. Like, I don't want to avoid it because that feels tone deaf,
right?
Question. But it's hard to think about, like, what minor thing is bothering you when the world is burning outside our doors. I agree with you, you know, for what it's worth, about your rose. Like, there is this weird boomerang effect of being present in this moment and having no choice but to be present. And so, yeah, just the feeling your toes in the sand, I can imagine that being such a comforting feeling, even if it's, you know, brief and a moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey, what about you?
I mean, I would definitely echo Liz's sentiments around my thorn, or in the world's thorn, in this particular moment, for sure. It feels, you know, I mean, this is probably without a doubt one of the hardest, heaviest moments that, you know, we may experience in our lifetimes. And Liz articulated everything very well, and I'm grateful for that. I would say, I guess the positive or the rose is, you know, I just attended a Zoom birthday party. Liz and I were part of this virtual food festival. I've been feeling connected to people and to friends and to family members and to loved ones in a way that I actually didn't always feel connected to before this moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, there's a resilience, I think, you know, that we're experiencing. Speaking to your question at the beginning, Micah, about how camp prepared us for this adaptability and this resourcefulness, I think that, you know, like, you know, we're 2.5-3 months in, and like, of course, it's someone's birthday. We're going to make them feel special, even if we can't all be there. And of course, we're going to come together in community, even if it means it's going to be mediated through a computer or a phone. And yes, we're able to be present and be outside and take walks and do those things. And so I'm just appreciating the resilience of the human spirit. I mean, even honestly, as upsetting as what's going on now is, there is something inspiring about the fact that people are out protesting, that in this moment, there is a chance to do something for good, not just sitting around watching Netflix. And there is a feeling I have that I'm sitting with of potential, of hope, as desperate and awful as some of what's going on is, and how it feels right now, and how traumatic in some ways this moment is. I actually, you know, there's a part of me that feels optimistic that maybe this is finally the time when there'll be change, and there are people that are finally demanding change, and like, I'm, you know, hoping to be able to be one of those people that is demanding that change right now. And so, I think it's just the resilience of the human spirit and a chance for making things better than they were now that everything's crumbling.
Yeah, well said on both counts. And you know, I'll only add for, you know, for my bitch and my rose is you know, the bitch is everything you just said, and I think it's just continuing to be astonished at how, you know, take aside, you know, even the protesters, just the people who still can't seem to recognize the moment we're living in. It's just so disheartening. And then at the same time, I couldn't agree more that there is something so inspiring about seeing the way people are working together, and seeing, you know, people finally taking a stand. And I don't mean, you know, minorities, because they've been trying to tell people, you know, for decades, for, you know, centuries. But it does feel, at least at this moment, as we're recording this at the beginning of June, when, you know, we're really, I mean, it doesn't seem like this is going away anytime soon, and who, you know, this episode may not come out for a few weeks, but as we're recording this, the starting of the protests and the riots is still fairly fresh in our lives. But people really do seem to be taking notice in a way that maybe they hadn't before. And it's so frustrating that it took all this for that to happen, but, you know, it is at least happening. And there is, I think, some, you know, a glimmer of hope to be taken from that, for sure. Yeah, it's hard not to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's also good to talk about this stuff. And I think that's probably one of the other lessons we're learning from this, is that we can't be silent anymore. We have to speak out. We have to get involved. And it seems like a lot of people are doing that. Or I live in a social media bubble. It's one of the two, or both.
Hard to say. Hard to know.
Yeah. But with that, that's our show. If you want to listen to other episodes of the podcast, you can always subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, any other podcast listening tool you can find. If you want to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, we are at Summer Camp Pod, and on Instagram at Campfires and Color Wars. You can tune in every Saturday night during quarantine and perhaps beyond for America's favorite non-Indigo Girls quarantine content, Jewish Geography Zoom Racing. It's not who you know, it's who you know knows. Streaming it live every Saturday night on our Facebook page at 9 o'clock Eastern. If you want to tell us your memories of camp food, please feel free to send us a note. You can send us an email at summercamppod@gmail.com. And Jeffrey and Liz, if people want to find you guys and all this cool stuff that you're doing, where can we send them online?
You can go to our Instagram account at Gefilteria, that's GEFILTERIA, or our website, gefilteria.com. And we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/Gefilteria.
And do you imagine, based on the what sounds like the smashing success of the food festival, that this is something you'll be looking to do again? And if so, is that, you know, I mean, it's early and obviously you just finished it, so you may not have this answer yet, but Is this something you could see doing multiple times in a year, or is this like a yearly thing, or is this a quarantine specific event?
I think it remains to be seen. We're really happy with what we were able to do. Obviously these conditions were ripe for this kind of response. And I think that, I hope we won't need to do this again, because I hope that people in the food world will all be busy working and doing things in the real world. If that's not the case, perhaps. But I think that for now, we're just really, however we can, want to support our industry and our peers.
That's great. Well, if you want to hear more from me, I am on Twitter at Micah Hart. And with that, we will see you next time on Campfires and Color Wars. And guys, when my dad, who's a camp director, every summer he would always say that time is precious and you really have to enjoy, every single minute of it. So he would always tell us, don't waste a minute. So I like to close the show by saying that. So I will say to you, Jeffrey and Liz, don't waste a minute. And you can say back to me,
Micah, don't waste a minute.
Nice.
Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself be. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs.